Obama's judicial nominations of Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan to the Supreme Court are also understandable in the context of the anti-colonial theory. Sotomayor is the voice of the oppressed. Her controversial statement, "I would hope a wise Latina woman with the richness of her experience would more often than not reach a better conclusion than a white male who hasn't lived that life," probably commended her to Obama. Sotomayor was saying, in effect, that white male judges reflect one narrow point of view, while non-white women reflect a quite different and superior perspective. The former can be seen to represent the colonizers, and the latter, the colonized. "We're ready for your promotion, Sonia." The most controversial facet of Elena Kagan's career has been her decision as dean of the Harvard Law School to kick military recruiters off campus. During her hearings, Kagan insisted that her decision still permitted the military to recruit at Harvard, which was true, though they were limited in a way that other recruiters weren't. When Kagan, as dean, backed down from her original decision, it was done in order to avoid jeopardizing Harvard's eligibility for federal funds. But it would not be surprising if Kagan's hostility to military recruitment caught the approving attention of President Obama. Let's turn to foreign policy and continue our application of the anti-colonial thesis to see how much it illuminates. In July 2010, Obama fired America's top commander in Afghanistan, General Stanley McChrystal, for his insubordinate remarks as revealed in a Rolling Stone interview. Whether or not the magazine used not-for-attribution quotations, as McChrystal's staff alleged, the firing, in my view, was justified because military commanders should not speak so disrespectfully of their civilian commander-in-chief. Even so, the content of what McChrystal and his aides said is telling. Most of them were contemptuous of Vice President Joe Biden, regarding him a buffoon. McChrystal apparently found Biden's solutions for the region silly, saying they would lead to chaosistan. The McChrystal team's reaction to Obama, however, was quite different. Obama frustrated them because they found him unreachable and impenetrable, basically uninterested in the facts on the ground and what the coalition forces were trying to do. McChrystal and his staff officer tried to explain the counterinsurgency strategy to the president, but Obama didn't seem to care. As a McChrystal aide put it, the president didn't seem very engaged. Now, why would a president who has a big political stake in Afghanistan not care about proposed strategies to successfully prosecute the offensive and maybe even win the war? Short answer, because he doesn't want to win. If Obama views Afghanistan as a war of colonial occupation, then his only concern is how fast he can get America out. But wait a minute. Didn't Obama order an additional 30,000 troops to Afghanistan? Yes, but the Obama surge was a political necessity. Recall that Obama had campaigned on the position that Iraq was the bad war and Afghanistan was the good war. We don't know at this point if Obama actually considered Afghanistan a good war. Later, I will show that he did not. At the time, however, Afghanistan was a convenient way for Obama to seem tough on terrorism while calling for an American pullout in Iraq. The rhetorical strategy worked. It helped Obama get to the White House with his anti-terrorist credentials intact. But then Obama, who might never have favored a victory in Afghanistan, was presented in 2009 by McChrystal with a strategy for success that required additional troops. Obama agreed to send them, but grudgingly, and he sent fewer than McChrystal said were necessary. As Thomas Friedman wrote in the New York Times, "The ugly truth is that no one in the Obama White House wanted this Afghan surge. The only reason they proceeded was because no one knew how to get out of it or had the courage to pull the plug." But while announcing the surge, Obama also insisted that he would withdraw U.S. troops from Afghanistan in a year. "There's got to be an exit strategy," Obama said, and then added, going into his very subtle translator mode, "There's got to be a sense that this is not perpetual drift." Obviously, the withdrawal announcement undercut the surge, because enemies are likely to hold out more tenaciously, even against a bigger force, if they are assured that the whole operation will end in the not-too-distant future. As The Economist candidly noted, there is almost no chance that Afghanistan will be transformed by the time of Obama's deadline. Obama's conservative critics treated this as just another Obama bungle, but it makes more sense to hold that Obama doesn't really care about whether Afghanistan is transformed or not. His goal is not success in Afghanistan. Rather, it is how quickly he can get America out. His anti-colonial strategy doffs a hat to political reality, but also ensures, win or lose, a prompt pullout from a war he doesn't want to fight. Moreover, if America and NATO are seen to have lost Afghanistan, that would be a good thing, because from the anti-colonial point of view, such a defeat would discourage colonial military expeditions in the future. Let's move our sights from Afghanistan to the Middle East. In recent months, Obama caused a stir by allowing a public rift to emerge with the Israeli government over the building of additional settlements. Michael Oren, Israel's ambassador to the United States, charged that the rift was the worst political crisis between the two countries in more than 3 decades. Israel is so besieged around the world, even in Europe, that Washington usually takes extra care to be protective of her Middle Eastern ally. But not Obama. Sure, the Obama administration publicly denied the rift. Jews, after all, are a vital base of political and financial support for the Democratic Party, but no credible observer believes Obama's heart is with the Jewish state. In July 2010, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu appeared at a joint press conference with Obama and agreed to ease Israel's blockade of the Gaza Strip. Netanyahu also pledged Israel's commitment to making peace with the Palestinians. He told Fox News he would put East Jerusalem on the negotiating table as a possible capital of a Palestinian state. Obama welcomed Netanyahu's concessions, which seemed to have been the necessary price to pay for Israel to mend fences with its most important ally and protector. Obama had humbled Netanyahu, and he had also made his own feelings clear. Obama disapproves of Israel's actions, and he did not hesitate to warn the Israeli government that he is not Israel's uncritical cheerleader. Obama, in fact, has a history of siding with Israel's opponents. During the presidential primary campaign, Obama stirred controversy by telling Democratic activists in Iowa, "Nobody is suffering more than the Palestinian people." In reality, lots of people in the world are worse off than the Palestinians. Still, Obama's statement clearly indicated how strongly he felt about the Palestinian cause. While he was a state senator in Illinois, Obama befriended the scholar Rashid Khalidi, who has strongly defended the right of Palestinians to use armed resistance against Israel. The Muslim blogger Ali Abu Nima wrote that he saw Obama a half dozen times at Chicago events organized by the Arab and Palestinian community. He recalled Obama attending a May 1998 fundraiser in which the keynote speaker was anti-colonial scholar and former PLO representative Edward Said. According to Abu Nima, during the 2004 Senate campaign, Obama praised Abu Nima's Chicago Tribune columns attacking Israel and urged him to keep up the good work for the Palestinian cause. Obama also added, "Hey, I'm sorry I haven't said more about Palestine right now, but we're in a tough primary race. I'm hoping when things calm down, I can be more upfront." Doesn't all of this make sense under the presumption that Obama regards Israel's occupation of the West Bank and Gaza as a war of colonial aggression? In April 2010, Obama held a nuclear security summit in Washington, D.C., in which 47 countries agreed to a joint statement condemning nuclear proliferation. The highlight of the event was an announcement that after months of bargaining, the United States and Russia had agreed to new, deep weapons reductions and updated verification rules that would see their strategic arsenals drop to 1,550 warheads, one-third below previously agreed levels. Many countries, including Canada, Chile, and Mexico, agreed to dispose of their stockpiles of enriched uranium and plutonium. Italy and Argentina promised they would install radiation detectors to check cargo for fissile material. All these initiatives were at the urging of the Obama administration. As one Obama official boasted, "We used the summit shamelessly as a forcing event to ask countries to bring house gifts." Which countries? Mainly, they were America's friends and allies. Conspicuously absent at the summit were North Korea and Iran, the former country in possession of nuclear weapons, the latter energetically engaged in the process of acquiring them. Obama didn't seem concerned by their absence, and White House officials were even quoted saying they didn't want the issues of North Korea and Iran to distract from what was being accomplished at the summit. Obama treated the world to his impressive vision of how wonderful it would be if we could be rid of nuclear weapons, and then everyone went home. Predictably, conservative columnists lambasted Obama, with Mark Stein calling the president dangerously delusional. Stein asked his readers to imagine Britain convening a disarmament conference in 1938 and inviting America, France, Brazil, Liberia, and Thailand, but not even mentioning Germany or Japan. How likely would it be that then Germany or Japan, wowed by all the Allied declarations of arms reductions, would agree to stop their own buildups? Charles Krauthammer, perhaps Obama's most trenchant critic, seconded these sentiments. Krauthammer scoffed at the U.S.-Russia deal and pointed out that the number of warheads in Russia's aging and decaying nuclear stockpile is an irrelevancy now that the existential U.S.-Soviet struggle is over. Krauthammer also noted that nuclear weapons are not in themselves dangerous. What's dangerous is when they are in the hands of the bad guys. In this case, the bad guys had gotten off scot-free. The very notion that Kim Jong-il or Mahmoud Ahmadinejad will suddenly abjure nukes because of yet another U.S.-Russian treaty is comical. This criticism was cogent enough when you consider its underlying assumption about Obama, that his goal was to discourage North Korea from expanding its nuclear arsenal and Iran from building one. If this was indeed Obama's objective, then the critics are right. The man is an idiot. But here is where our anti-colonial hypothesis pays huge dividends. In fact, it shows that the joke is really on Obama's critics. Let's shift the underlying assumption and replace it with this one. Obama's goal is not to discourage Iran or North Korea, but rather to limit the nuclear capability of the United States and its allies. Consider the possibility that Obama views America as the neocolonial titan in the world and its allies as support structures for Pax Americana. Now the summit can be viewed as an ingenious and completely successful effort to reduce American power in the world. In fact, the outcome is all the more brilliant because Obama was able to achieve this while posing as the champion of the worldwide eradication of nuclear weapons, thus enhancing his reputation as a global peacemaker. So let's see where we are at this point. We have a powerful model, the anti-colonial model, that seems to make sense of many of Obama's actions. Other theories work like hammers. They have to beat away at Obama's statements and actions in order to fit them to some preconceived theory. This theory is not preconceived, but supplied to us by Obama himself. And it works like a nifty screwdriver that, with just a little effort and application, immediately gets the job done. I now want to proceed in two stages. First, to examine how that anti-colonial ideology developed in Obama's life and mind, and second, to apply it in greater detail to Obama's policies. I intend to tell the remarkable story of Obama's life, showing at each stage how his ideas formed, how they progressed into a cohesive ideology, how the ideology found an effective implementation strategy, and finally, how that strategy brought Obama into the Oval Office. After that, I intend to systematically examine Obama's key policies, both domestic and foreign, to expose what this man is doing to America. It's a riveting story, and told in a way you haven't heard before, but if you care about America's prosperity and security, I might as well forewarn you. Be very afraid.